This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
Last Sunday, November 29th, in Honduras, the coup makers said it was the day of an election for a new president. Those who opposed the coup called it an event, not an election. There were polling booths, but how many voted is much in dispute. Sunday night, the coup makers declared they had counted 98% of the ballots and declared the winner between two candidates, both of whom supported the coup. However, they overlooked that their announced numbers showed 62% of registered voters didn't go to the polling booth. When this was publicized, the counters responded they had made a technical error. Instead of having counted all the votes, they now said they had counted only half. So they began counting again, but on Tuesday they announced their computers had broken down. Irene Lansinger is president of the BC Teachers Federation. She was in Honduras as part of a Canadian teachers delegation to witness voting day. She returned just this Thursday, and she joins us on the line to share information about what she saw. Greetings, Irene, and welcome to Vancouver Cooperative Radio.
Hello, Mordecai.
Now, what stance did the popular resistance to the coup in Honduras take vis-a-vis the election?
Well, they had had a strategy, by and large, of boycotting the elections, and one translation I heard of it was a people's curfew. People actually stayed home on election day. In most parts of the country, it was very quiet, with people not even leaving their homes. There was an exception in San Pedro Sula, which I'm sure we'll get to. After the election, the resistance claimed that, I believe they claimed that 21% of people had voted and 79% of people had stayed home. There were a lot of different numbers the day after the election, and you've given a good background to what the government claimed. There were other people who claimed 30 to 33% of people voted. I understood that the resistance said 21%. So the day after the election, it was not clear at all how many people had voted, but the small group I was with in San Pedro Sula went to two polling stations, both of which were very, very quiet. I think in a period of about 45 to 50 minutes over two polling stations, we saw one person vote, which is very, you know, even in Canada, where the population is more spread out and we have fairly low voter turnout in recent elections of around 50%. We see towards the end of the day of voting a lot more people at the polls than that.
Now, if we skip back to just before the election, there were reports, I don't know if they're true, that rewards were being offered to people to encourage them to vote. Did you see any evidence of that?
Oh, absolutely. The day after the election, there was an ad in the paper that we just were sitting waiting for a bus from our guest house and opened a paper, and there was an ad in the paper that offered a 50% discount to anybody who had voted, and it was some big electronics store. And it's clear whether you voted or not in Honduras, because when you vote, they put ink on your fingers, and so people who had voted had, and that lasts apparently about 2 days. So after the election, if you went in and showed by the ink on your fingers that you had voted, you got a 50% discount. On the other hand, the symbol of the resistance the day after the election became holding up your two pinky fingers to show that you hadn't voted. So that the whole business of indicating whether or not you had voted by showing your fingers was a kind of symbol in the election of which side you were on.
You said that you were in San Pedro Sula, the city of Pedro Sula, on voting day, and the polling stations were pretty sparse. But what else did you see there?
Yes, well, we had gotten to San Pedro Sula on Saturday and had actually gone listen in on a meeting of the resistance leaders who were planning their strategy for the following day. As you know, and I should probably mention, the teachers have been, as several descriptions describe the teachers' unions and teachers, as the spine of the resistance. They've been very, very active in and vocal in the anti-coup forces. And actually, one of the reasons that I went and a number of teachers from Ontario went was because to show solidarity with the teachers' unions that we have had many projects with over the years. So these leaders met on Saturday night to decide their strategy and decided that, contrary to the rest of the country, they felt it was important to be vocal about their resistance to the elections and their belief that the elections were fraudulent. And so they organized a march and a demonstration for the following day. And that began at about 10 o'clock on Sunday morning. They began to gather in the market area, and they were going to march from the market to the square, which they did. There was about 200 people, I think, when they started out. A little small truck with a loudspeaker and people marching with flags. And the military came through, police came through a few times with pickup trucks with people with machine guns on the back, and that always seemed to incite the crowd to shout out slogans. There was a particular tension between the police and the marchers and protesters, and that was very, very evident. And the march was peaceful. People were carrying crosses. As I'm sure you know, many people have been murdered in the resistance to the coup, and so there were crosses for each of the murdered or disappeared, and they carried those crosses in the march. They varied. There were police kind of on the edges of the march, and a couple of times it seemed to me that they varied the route of the march in response to where the military and police were. That march ended up in the square, the central square of San Pedro Sula, and the truck continued to shout out instructions to the protesters, asking them to not provoke the police, to sit down at one stage. They sang the national anthem at one stage. The woman on the loudspeaker told them to go into the central square. But when we got to the square, the police and the military, there was a very, very large military police presence on one of the streets leading into the square, and many of the protesters moved in front of the military and were shouting their slogans. I was standing at the back. One of the younger University of Michigan students that was in our small group of five went up to the front, and another teacher from Ontario went up to the front to find out where he'd gone. And so we really, I think, between the five of us, had a pretty good view of all parts of the protest, and none of us saw any provocation of the police at all. But after a certain period of time, Scott Marshall, who's from the Ontario Secondary School Teachers Federation, came back to where I was standing and told me that the police had put their tear gas masks on, and so we suspected that that was an indication that something was going to happen, and sure enough, 5 or 10 minutes later, they fired tear gas on the crowd. They fired the water cannon into the crowd, and the police started advancing on the crowd. As soon as they fired the tear gas, the crowd started to run away from the tear gas. And I started to run as fast as I could. Scott, we had sort of agreed that we would pair up, right? So I was with Scott from OSSTF, and we ran away from the police. And Scott said to me, a very brave guy he is, said, we should stop and film some of this. So he did. We stopped and he filmed for a little bit, but when the police raised their machine guns, I said, Scott, you know, we got to go, we got to get out of here. So we turned around and started to run towards the back of the square. There was a Honduran at the back of the square. It was amazing. The people were very aware of us. I am, you know, quite tall with blonde hair, and I really stand out in the Latin American crowd as someone who's not Latin American. And so there was a Honduran at the back of the square who advised us to go right instead of left, which was extremely good advice because the majority of the runners at this particular point were going left. The police went left, and they fired tear gas down that narrow street, which was a real thick cloud of tear gas, and going right, we avoided most of the tear gas. And there actually, the reason he told us to go that way was that there was a hotel that was well known for allowing people in. In these kinds of situations. However, we didn't go in. We stayed in the square, and we observed about 4 or 5 people who had been injured. The Red Cross arrived to help out those people, and when we we kind of thought there were several human rights groups there who at a point like that take witness accounts, and so a number of them asked me to give a witness account, which I did. And then when it seemed to be settling down, we had agreed to meet back at the hotel. There were five of us in our small group. The delegation we had was about 20, but we all went to different places for Election Day. So we met back at the hotel, and after a short period of time, I heard helicopters and went out in front, and our group of five and a few others were standing in the hotel. We were not even in front of the hotel. We were not even standing in a group. I walked down to the corner where the streets come away from the square, right? We were on a kind of cross street, and sure enough, within a few minutes, people started running down our street away from the square, the police behind them, and the police fired two tear gas canisters into the street that our hotel was on. So at that point, I had the tear gas and the hotel behind me, and I had the choice of running away from the hotel or into the tear gas, but I chose the security of the hotel and ran through the tear gas into the hotel. That was completely unprovoked. There were seven or eight of us standing around just sort of looking to see what was happening. The majority of us were foreigners, part of our delegation, but at that point it was my perception that the police were simply blanketing the downtown area of San Pedro Sula with tear gas to encourage people to go into their houses and not come out at all.
So how much of a role did the police or the army play at polling stations?
Yeah, shortly after that, we got into the van and decided that we would go to two of the polling stations in town and observe the election process. And on the outside of the polling station, there's a huge military truck with military and guns at every polling station. So both polling stations we went to, there was a very significant military presence just outside the entrance to the school. Both of the stations we went to were in elementary schools. I didn't observe military inside the polling station, though it's my understanding that the military was responsible for organizing the election. There was some kind of tribunal also responsible, but the military essentially was responsible for the organization of the election, delivering ballots. They were present outside the election polling station. And as I said, we observed very few people voting.
The Canadian government has issued a statement saying it's quite satisfied with the election, that there was a large turnout, that things were done fairly. What's your response?
I don't know how they are coming to that conclusion. It was absolutely clear to me that there was a significant suppression in San Pedro Sula of the right to free speech. People were demonstrating peacefully and were tear gassed and beaten. We saw several people who had been detained and beaten by police after that incident in the square. One young man who was beaten so badly and had pepper sprayed so badly that he couldn't even open his eyes. And of course, those people were let go right after we arrived. So there was significant violence and repression of rights in San Pedro Sula. And the issue of how many people voted, remember, this is voting after a coup, right? And we phoned the Canadian Embassy on Sunday night, election night, to tell them what we had observed. They phoned back. We spoke to Canadian Embassy officials twice on election day. So they had lots of information, eyewitness accounts from Canadians about what happened. And so Peter Kent's statement was amazing to us, and we issued a press release in response to it saying that was completely counter to what we had observed.
Well, thank you very much for taking time, Irene, and thank you for going down to observe in Honduras itself.
Thank you, Mordecai, for covering it.
I've been speaking with Irene Lansinger. She's president of the BC Teachers Federation. She just returned from Honduras, where she visited with a teachers' delegation from across Canada to witness the so-called election held there this past Sunday.